Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, serious new blows to Donald Trump's big lie about the election. An Arizona audit baselessly demanded by Republicans backfires, reaffirming President Biden's win. And Trump loyalists are hit with subpoenas by the January 6th Select Committee. I'll talk with journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, who detailed Trump's assault on democracy in their brand new book. Also tonight, millions of Americans officially have the green light to get COVID vaccine boosters. But the CDC director's decision is fueling some new confusion. Why did she okay shots for frontline workers when her advisors voted against it? And the makeshift migrant camp under a Texas bridge has now been cleared. But the controversy over Border Patrol tactics continues, the president condemning the embarrassment on his watch. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. We begin with a real and present danger to American democracy coming from the former president of the United States. Donald Trump is clinging to his big lie tonight, despite new setbacks in that partisan Arizona election audit and the investigation of the insurrection. Trump took another hit just a little while ago. The White House now says President Biden will not shield Trump-era records from the January 6th Select Committee. Our senior legal affairs correspondent, Paula Reed, is covering it all for us tonight. Paula, the former president is lashing out as his bogus claims of election fraud are being exposed and undermined.
That's right, Wolf. Once again, Trump's claims of fraud are being debunked, this time in Arizona. And this comes as the House Select Committee escalates its investigation into the January 6th insurrection and efforts to sow doubt about the 2020 election, issuing its first subpoenas to four of Trump's closest allies who have all helped him promote the big lie.
In his quest to spread the big lie, Trump has focused on the vote count in Arizona. His allies paid a company to find fraud. But 5 months and more than $5 million later, the results are in. They found none. In fact, a hand recount actually found more votes for Joe Biden. Late last night, Trump posted a statement online calling the firm reviewing the Arizona results highly respected auditors. But after the results confirming his loss were widely reported, the statement was deleted from his website. The sham process was conducted by the Florida-based company Cyber Ninjas, which has no experience in auditing, but a hand recount by the company showed Biden got 99 more votes than Maricopa County originally reported, and Trump received 261 fewer votes. Maricopa County Supervisor, Republican Bill Gates, bucked his own party to reject the sham process.
Those behind this, they don't have reverence for democracy. They are trying to sow doubt so that down the road, they can again question elections if they don't turn out the way they wanted them to.
But the former president continues to spread the big lie. On Thursday, Trump published a letter to the Republican governor of Texas, a state he won by more than 5 points, demanding an election audit while making baseless allegations. Texans know voting fraud occurred in some of their counties. Let's get to the bottom of the 2020 presidential election scam. Hours later, the Secretary of State announced that Texas would carry out audits in four of the state's largest counties. Trump's efforts to undermine confidence in the system is being embraced by Republicans. In a recent CNN poll, most Republicans said they want Trump to remain their party's leader. And most Republicans also consider support for Trump and his false claim to have won the 2020 election to be an important part of their own partisan identity, alongside support for conservative principles. Nearly 10 months after the 2020 election, the former president continues to trash even his closest allies if they don't support the big lie. In a new book, Peril, authors Bob Woodward and Robert Costa document how Senators Lindsey Graham and Mike Lee questioned Trump's claim that the election was stolen.
These two Trump supporters come up with the conclusion, it's bogus. There is nothing there.
Now Trump is taking aim at the two lawmakers who were staunch allies and frequently seen by his side while in office. I spent virtually no time with them, Trump wrote in a statement. Lindsey and Mike should be ashamed of themselves for not putting up the fight necessary to win. This comes as the House Select Committee fired off its first round of subpoenas in its investigation into January 6th to four Trump loyalists. Investigators want to know what Trump and those around him did to try to overturn the results of the 2020 election, in addition to what was known in Trump's orbit about the planning leading up to the insurrection and how the administration responded.
We're moving with great alacrity, and essentially no one is off the table.
The committee has specifically targeted individuals they believe would be uncooperative. They include Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, former advisor Steve Bannon, and Kash Patel, a former chief of staff to then acting Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller.
These are four important witnesses. They're all very close to the former president. Some were in direct communication with him on January 5th, on January 6th. They are reportedly in communication about how to overturn the results of the election.
On January 5th, Bannon predicted on his podcast,
all hell is going to break loose.
In a letter to Meadows, the committee noted he was allegedly communicating with the president on January 6th, and they also want to know more about his efforts to plan and prepare to contest the presidential election and delay counting of electoral votes. The committee is looking for a quick turnaround, and all four Trump associates are directed to produce relevant documents by October 7th and appear for depositions the following week.
Look at that.
CNN has reached out to Meadows, Scavino, and Bannon for comment. Patel said in a statement late Thursday that he was disappointed but not surprised that the committee had subpoenaed him before seeking voluntary cooperation.
The White House says President Biden is not inclined to invoke executive privilege to block any of these requests, and that is bad news for Trump and his associates, as this committee's investigation is really broad, and the subpoenas to this group of advisors is likely just the beginning.
You're absolutely right. Paula Reed reporting for us. Thank you very much. There's a lot to discuss with our guests this hour. Journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa are joining us. They're the co-authors of the brand new best-selling book entitled Peril.
Thank you.
Here it is.
Good to be
Thank
here.
You.
Excellent new book. Thanks, guys.
Thank you
very much for writing it. Bob, you report extensively in this book, Peril, about Trump's developments during, leading up to January 6th, since January 6th and all that. But what are these new developments we're now learning about tell you about the staying power of his allegations, the staying power, especially among Republicans who continue to spout a lot of this?
Well, it's more than staying power. It's passion for Trump. The numbers, as you point out, are astounding. What we discovered in the reporting on the book is that two of the Trump loyalists, Lindsey Graham, Senator Mike Lee from Utah, conservative, very devoted to Trump, investigated these claims through memos that Rudy Giuliani and a White House lawyer named John Eastman gave them. And it was the kind of investigation predisposed to, oh, okay, there's going to be supporting evidence here. They found the absolute opposite, zero, nothing. And both went, both Senators Graham and Mike Lee went on the floor of the Senate and said, no, nothing, and walked away. So what does that mean? I mean, I think if you're you really want to look at the facts, as we tried to do here, and you, if you like Trump or don't like Trump, read what his allies concluded that this stolen election claim is untrue.
But do you see this? Do you see this as an assault on democracy by Trump and his supporters?
Well, you know, we're just people will judge it. What is stunning is, and Lindsey Graham, who, you know, for Trump to say he's not, doesn't talk to Graham, they play golf all the time. They played golf last Friday, I believe. And so, you know, the golf course and the political discussions are endless. So anyway, people can assess the facts here.
Bob, in the book, you outline how Senators Graham and Lee poured a lot of cold water, as we just reported, on Trump's allegations, the coup attempt, as it's being called. Now the former president, let me put it up on the screen, is saying this. This is the former president. Lindsey and Mike should be ashamed of themselves for not putting up the fight necessary to win. So does every GOP politician take note of that, how the former president reacts?
Let's understand why he's reacting in that way. The conventional wisdom on January 6th is that President Trump was idly watching television in the West Wing. What we show in our reporting is that on January 2nd, Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani are meeting with Senator Graham. And January 2nd through January 5th, you have a pressure campaign on Vice President Pence. You have a January 5th meeting in the Oval Office. Dan Scavino's in there. And then you have Bannon talking with the president on January 5th. So it's not just these two senators who are talking with the president. It's the president actively trying to get Pence to throw out the electors on January 6th, to get Scavino in one scene in our book, to help him, to pressure lawmakers to coordinate with him on January 6th and do some kind of move to decertify Biden. Big picture, the January 6th commission wants to know what was really happening January 2nd through 5th, as well as on January 6th. And that's why the committee has cited our book in these subpoenaed documents. They realize Bannon was talking to Trump in December, in January. Scavino was there working on the tweets. This was a massive operation on the Trump side.
You know, just how much pressure was the former president, then president, actually putting on his aides and others to try to launch this kind of coup?
It was absolute. The investment, I mean, what the reporting shows, and Costa has the exact quotes, the interesting pressure was Trump to Pence.
Oh, that was the moment. It could have been a constitutional crisis. We've discussed this a lot. I mean, there was that Eastman memo that was first reported in our book.
That law professor.
Done terrific reporting on it as well. And you see, this is not just a conversation on January 5th in the Oval. It's a document saying to the vice president from a conservative legal expert in the view of the Trump side, at least, that you can do this. That's what he said to Vice President Pence on January 4th, a meeting in the Oval Office. Listen to Eastman, Mike. Listen to John.
Look at these poll numbers. I want your assessment because you've reported on several presidents over these years. Look at this poll. A huge jump in Republicans who have, quote, no confidence at all that the 2020 presidential election was fair. If you take a look, 63% of Republicans don't think the election was fair compared to others. Take a look at 2016, 10%, 2012, 12%, 2008, 6%, 11%. No confidence at all. These are among the losing candidates' parties. Look at how it's jumped up to 63%.
It's astonishing, and that's why the proper word is passion that these people feel for Trump. And Trump has kind of, since he left office January 20th, has laid out his rationale for the candidacy. It was a stolen election, and people are signing up to the stolen election argument. And, we spent months looking around. Is there something here? Is there some? And you now see in Arizona, they did the count, and it shows very clearly
Biden actually got a few more votes.
Yeah. And so, we put out the call as much as you can as a reporter to anyone in the Trump campaign organization we want to hear. That's how we got to the Giuliani memo and our series of memos that he sent to Lindsey Graham and the John Eastman memo by searching for and through Trump supporters.
No one's stopping him. You have Bill Barr knowing in November of 2020 that it's all BS, his words, based on our reporting on the voting fraud in the machines. And everyone seems to, around President Trump, know he's going in the wrong direction, know he's spouting lies about the election, but very little is done to corral him.
In the end, though, Pence, the vice president, did certify the election as president of the Senate. I give him credit for that. All right, the book is entitled Peril, Bob Woodward, Robert Costa. Guys, thanks so much for writing this book. Must read.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very, very much. Just ahead, we're going to drill down on those new subpoenas for Trump loyalists to testify in the investigation of the insurrection. A prominent member of the January 6th Select Committee, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, there you see him, Adam Schiff. He's standing by live. We'll discuss when we come back. Tonight, the January 6th Select Committee has issued its first subpoena as the panel targeting four top Trump loyalists. We're joined by a key member of the committee, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, Congressman Adam Schiff. Mr. Chairman, thanks so much for joining us. Why are these four witnesses who've just been subpoenaed, all close Trump aides, so critical to your investigation?
Well, because they were in and around the president on these pivotal days, on January 5th, on January 6th. They were in communication, some of them with each other, others with the president. And we want to know, what was the administration aware of in the run-up to January 6th? What did they know about the propensity for violence among those that were being rallied to come to this Stop the Steal event, as the president's campaign billed it? What was going on at the Pentagon? And this will help us fill out the picture of what led to that bloody insurrection. And we need to know all the facts in order to be able to protect the country going forward.
Indeed. The former President Trump, he reacted saying, and I'm quoting him now, "We will fight the subpoenas on executive privilege and other grounds, calling your investigation," once again, I'm quoting, "unselect committee." Does that threat by the former president have any teeth? Because the White House, the current White House, says President Biden wouldn't assert executive privilege.
Well, first of all, it's very encouraging that the Biden administration is not going to allow those that were potentially implicated in January 6th to hide behind bogus claims of privilege. So that's very encouraging from the Biden administration. We wouldn't expect anything different from Donald Trump. Look, he spent 4 years stonewalling all subpoenas. He spent the last couple years pushing out this big lie, and now he's continuing to push out the big lie. So this is not surprising. We're going to use whatever compulsion we need to get these witnesses to testify. And we went straight to subpoenas because we were aware that they might very well try to do what they did, frankly, in the last administration, that is run out the clock for years and years.
The chairman of the Select Committee, Benny Thompson, says if these witnesses don't comply, then, I'm quoting now, criminal contempt or other measures will be open to us. That's a quote from Benny Thompson. What other measures, Mr. Chairman, are on the table?
Well, that is, frankly, the most probably the most severe measure. There are a number of ways to enforce subpoenas, as we've tried over the last 4 years. There is civil efforts to seek to effectuate those subpoenas in court, but that can be very time-consuming. Now, during the last administration, when Bill Barr was the attorney general, he was doing everything he could to protect the person of the country, not the country itself, which meant, of course, that he wasn't going to assist in enforcing subpoenas. But it's a very different Justice Department now that puts the public interest first. And so if people, you know, willfully ignore the law and they defy these subpoenas, then pursuing a criminal contempt is viable. And we would hope that we would have the support of the Justice Department in that. We have to reestablish that people can't simply thumb their nose at legal process and get away with it.
While you're investigating the lies that led to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, a former president is continuing this effort, lashing out at senators for not fighting harder for his coup attempt, calling on Texas right now, the state of Texas, to audit the 2020 election. How dangerous is all of this?
It's extremely dangerous because, you know, what the former president is doing and has been doing is undermining one of the pillars of our democracy, and that is that we settle our disputes at the polling place, that we believe in our election system, that we have faith in our democracy. He's undermining that faith. In California, where we just had a recall election, the recall was overwhelmingly defeated. And of course, Trump and his allies and Republican Party officials around the country make bogus claims of fraud. And sadly, a great many people believe them. I saw some polling out of California that showed a very high degree of Republicans, high percentage of Republicans, who believe now those big lies about the California election. So it's deeply damaging to our democracy.
It certainly is. Congressman Adam Schiff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Wolf.
Coming up, a rare split between the head of the CDC and the agency's vaccine advisors on COVID booster shots. We're going to take a closer look at who's eligible now to get one. We'll be right back. A rare move by the head of the CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, splitting with her own vaccine advisors and backing COVID vaccine booster shots for people age 18 to 64 who are at higher risk because of their work setting or living situations. The advisors had rejected that, recommending boosters only for people age 65 and older and American adults with underlying medical conditions. Let's dig deeper with our chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Sanjay, I want you and our viewers to watch how the CDC director explained her decision today. Listen to this.
I want to be very clear that I did not overrule an advisory committee. I listened to the comments on the votes, and this was a scientific close call.
So walk us through what happened here, Sanjay.
Well, I think the biggest thing was basically determining how much of an impact would boosters have on healthy people under the age of 65 who worked in high exposure settings, like hospitals, healthcare workers, grocery stores, frontline workers, that sort of thing. The advisory committee said that they didn't think there'd be that much of an impact from providing boosters for those people. And Dr. Walensky basically said she thought there would be. So it was erring on the side of providing more boosters. Let me show you this graph really quickly, Wolf. We put this together for you. You know, just saying, like, how much of an impact would boosters make on people? If you look at the far right of the screen, that's people 65 plus. You can see that blue graph there, that shows that there's quite a bit of impact on hospitalizations among older people. If you go to the left, people much younger, there's hardly any impact on hospitalizations because they're far less likely to be hospitalized, but there may be a impact on cases. How many cases of COVID are actually diagnosed in that age group before and after boosters? There seems to be some benefit, according to these modeling studies, of using boosters. But admittedly, Wolf, it's not really ironclad evidence that the vaccines help as much with transmission. Certainly they help, but how much do they help exactly? I think that was the point of contention. Nevertheless, that was the specific disagreement.
So who should be going out right now, Sanjay, and getting a booster?
Well, I can put up the list here. And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the CDC's language on this, they have a couple of categories of should go get the booster, 65 plus age group, people who live in long-term care facilities, but also people ages 50 to 64 who have underlying conditions. And that could be a long list of conditions. I'll mention those as well. But then also eligible are people, again, 18 to 49 with underlying conditions, and anybody, frankly, above 18 who has a job that might put them at risk. People have asked a lot, Wolf, I'll tell you quickly, about what are those conditions that potentially make you higher risk for severe COVID. And that is also a long list. Cancer, kidney disease, lung disease, including moderate to severe asthma, diabetes, obesity. So you can see the list there. But when you add it all up, the people over the age of 65, and then all people who may fall into the categories of having one of these conditions, you're talking, 170 million people, roughly, Wolf. So even though it's still these categories, it's a large segment of the population that would be affected by these recommendations.
Yes, about half the population right there. Sanjay, yeah. I want you to stand by. I want to bring in Dr. Paul Offit, the director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's also a key member of the FDA Vaccines Advisory Committee. And he's the author of a brand new book. There you see the cover, You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. Dr. Offit, thanks very much for writing this book. Thanks very much for joining us. As I said, you're one of the FDA advisors. What do you make of the CDC director's booster guidance, Dr. Walensky's decision to go ahead and basically challenge what some of her advisors were telling her?
I think this would have been a lot easier if instead of saying greater than 18 years of age, that they had said greater than 30 years of age, both for the sort of high-risk individual as well as just for people who work in either occupations or institutions where transmission is high. Because that's what worries people. What worries people is the 18 to 29-year-old is at higher risk of this side effect, myocarditis, of mRNA vaccines. And if you look at the third dose of the Pfizer mRNA vaccine, it's a much greater immune response after the third dose and after the second dose. And so I think people are worried that in groups, for example, who are not at high risk of hospitalization or death, such as, for example, a healthy young 18 to 29-year-old, and now you're giving a third dose, that you might actually find that you're increasing the risk of myocarditis and you may that the benefits may be outweighed by the risks. I think that's what this boiled down to. There were two things that were said, though, yesterday in the CDC's meeting that hopefully didn't get lost. One is that the COVID working group said the priority is vaccinating the unvaccinated. That's our best chance to get on top of this pandemic. And the second thing they said that I think was really important was they said that for those of you in the general public who have received two doses of an mRNA-containing vaccine, you should consider yourself fully vaccinated. Because I think what happened, I think, with this under this whole sort of Biden administration push for a third dose, this kind of third dose fever, is that there's a lot of people now who wonder whether or not they really are vaccinated. And I think we scared people.
Yeah, there's still, 70 million or 80 million Americans who are eligible for a vaccine who have refused to get the shot, at least so far. I hope they change their minds up. And Dr. Offit, as you know, Dr. Fauci is cautioning people not to get their boosters too soon. And you write in your new book, You Bet Your Life, that there's some level of risk in every medical decision. So you're saying the risk is too high for the general public? Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm saying that the data that we have right now for the general public is that two doses of mRNA-containing vaccine, whether it's Pfizer or Moderna, appears to provide excellent protection against serious illness. That protection includes Delta variant and it includes all age groups. So right now, there's not a problem in terms of protection against serious disease. The issue then, however, is that over time with these kinds of vaccines, neutralizing antibody response in the circulation will start to decline. With that decline, you'll have an increased incidence of asymptomatic infection, mild symptomatic infection, even low moderately symptomatic infection, during which time you can be contagious. So the thinking was, okay, if we give a third dose, maybe we can decrease contagiousness and make some impact on this pandemic. But the question, I think Sanjay just brought it up, is really what kind of impact will it have as compared to what we really need to do, which is vaccinate the unvaccinated.
Good point, Dr. Offit. Congratulations on your new book, You Bet Your Life. I have it right here. Important reading. Sanjay, as usual, thanks to you as well. I know you got a new book coming out in a few weeks. We'll discuss that once that book is out as well. And just ahead, President Biden vows action amid outrage over disturbing images of border agents on horseback aggressively confronting migrants. The president saying, and I'm quoting him now, those people will pay. The path forward for President Biden's top legislative priorities is unclear at best tonight, with the president himself saying his own party is at a stalemate between moderates and progressives. CNN's chief national affairs correspondent Jeff Zeleny is over at the White House for us. Jeff, for lots of talking, but no sign of progress as President Biden's economic agenda right now is hanging in the balance.
Well, just a few moments ago, President Biden told reporters here at the White House as he left for a weekend in Camp David that he has just had another conversation with Speaker Pelosi about the way forward on this agenda. But he has said himself that there will be ups and downs in this long legislative process. But something notable happened today, Wolf. He sought to turn the conversation away from these trillion-dollar price tags. He said the price is actually zero because all of his programs would be paid for. The only problem? There's no consensus for how.
Now we're at this stalemate at the moment.
Tonight, President Biden delivering a blunt reality check on his economic agenda.
We're going to have to get these two pieces of legislation passed. Both need to be passed.
The president warned the resolution between progressives and moderates won't be quick or easy, but expressed optimism that divided Democrats will ultimately find consensus on his $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill and a far broader $3.5 trillion budget, addressing climate change and expanding the safety net for most Americans.
I make no apologies for my proposals, how I'm proceeding, and why I think by the end of the year we're going to be in a very different place.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi pledging to move ahead and bring the measures to the floor next week, hoping to break through the impasse. But key progressives warned that vote will fail.
We have at least 50 people who are not going to vote for that bill. Mm-hmm. So I think what we need is to take the temperature down a little bit. The vote is going to drive up tensions, not drive down tensions.
After a week of disturbing images from the southern border,
of course I take responsibility, I'm president.
Biden weighing in for the first time on how Border Patrol agents on horseback rounded up Haitian migrant families.
To see people treated like they did, horses barely running them over, people being strapped, it's outrageous. I promise you those people will pay. There will be consequences. It's an embarrassment, but it's beyond an embarrassment. It's dangerous. It's wrong. It sends the wrong message around the world.
Appearing on The View on ABC, Vice President Harris said the images of law enforcement officers on horses were horrific.
I was outraged by it. It was horrible and deeply troubling. There's been now an investigation that is being conducted, which I fully support, and there needs to be consequence and accountability. Human beings should not be treated that way. And
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas defended his department against comparison this week from some Democrats that Biden administration border policies are no better than ones under former President Trump.
Let me be quite clear. We do not conduct ourselves in an immoral way. We do not conduct ourselves in an unethical way. In fact, we are restoring people by reason of the immorality of the past administration. We are reuniting families that were separated.
And Secretary Mayorkas making clear that all migrants have been removed from that encampment in Del Rio, Texas. But Wolf, those searing images linger on.
They certainly do. All right, Jeff Zeleny at the White House, thank you very much. Let's get some more now on the crisis along the U.S.-Mexico border, where at one point some 15,000 migrants were camped under the bridge linking Del Rio, Texas to Mexico. Many of them originally, of course, from Haiti. CNN's Matt Rivers is in Mexico for us, just across the border from Del Rio. So, Matt, are there any migrants left? What are you seeing and hearing right now?
On the U.S. side of the border, Wolf, the answer is no to that. We can show our viewers video proof of that right now. You heard Jeff just say it there with Secretary Mayorkas saying that all remaining Haitian migrants on the U.S. side of the border have now been removed, either deported to Haiti or brought to other parts of the U.S. border with Mexico for immigration processing. However, that's a bit different than the scenario that's happening right here on the Mexico side. You can see behind me the remains an encampment here, and we can walk a little bit and show you where there are dozens, if not hundreds, of Haitian migrants that basically chose to stay here on the Mexico side. These are people who made the same journey from South America that all those people and all those images that we've seen, Wolf, over the past week, 10 days, that made that encampment of thousands of people on the U.S. side. These all are part of the same group. All of these people here are Haitian migrants. However, these people chose to stay here in Mexico because they were too afraid that if they went across to the United States, they would be deported. It's a very real fear that people have. And one thing that struck my team and I during the day today was listening to Secretary Mayorkas give that press conference. And he said that the United States had made the decision that conditions in Haiti are such that they believe Haiti can in fact absorb the thousands of deportees that they're sending back to Haiti. I wish I knew what kind of qualifications that the U.S. government used to make that decision, because we spent, my team and I, the better part of 2 months in Haiti between July and August. And I saw violence, I saw poverty, I saw some of the worst conditions that you can imagine after the earthquake that struck there on August 14th. There are thousands of internally displaced people in that country already, and yet the U.S. government making the decision to deport thousands of Haitians into what is already a country that is reeling. One man told us that he cannot believe that the Biden administration is making that decision. How could you send someone back to a country, he said, where violence, where poverty, and where corruption is still so pervasive? Well, if that is the fear that has driven Haitian migrants here on this side of the border to stay in Mexico rather than go to the United States.
Really awful situation indeed. All right, Matt Rivers, excellent reporting. Thank you very much. Coming up, two hosts of The View test positive for COVID moments before an interview with the Vice President Kamala Harris. We're going to show you the reality drama that followed. Plus, there's a new health twist emerging right now. The search for Brian Laundrie just ended for the night at a Florida nature preserve in the investigation of the homicide of his fiancée, Gabby Petito. CNN national correspondent Athena Jones has the latest on the manhunt.
Tonight, new details emerging surrounding Gabby Petito's fiancé, Brian Laundrie, last seen 10 days ago. His parents say he was heading to this massive nature reserve. A source close to Laundrie's family telling CNN he left his parents' Florida home without his cell phone or wallet, and that his parents were concerned he might try to hurt himself.
No 23-year-old leaves the house without his cell phone. He may have just completely manipulated and engineered this entire situation so that he could disappear without a trace.
Laundrie is now the subject of a federal arrest warrant for his alleged actions after Petito was killed. A federal grand jury indicting Laundrie for his alleged use of unauthorized access devices following Petito's death. The indictment alleging Laundrie had intent to defraud for using a debit card and PIN for accounts that were not his, though not specifying who the accounts belonged to. It says Laundrie racked up more than $1,000 in charges between August 30th and September 1st, the day police say Laundrie returned to Florida from the couple's cross-country road trip without Petito.
We're looking through wooded areas. We're looking through bodies of water. We're looking through swampy areas.
The search resuming for Laundrie Friday morning after pausing overnight because of darkness.
We're not wasting our time out here. We are doing our due diligence to find Brian and an area that intelligence had led us that he could possibly be in. And it's upon us to make sure that we search this area as best as we can.
Northport police showing what they are up against. The difficult, wet terrain covered in deep mud and marshland. Authorities have reported no sign of Laundrie after days of searching the treacherous wilderness.
I think he's a camper, not an outdoorsman. I don't think he can survive in that wilderness area. I don't think he can survive more than a couple days in there.
Now, a memorial service for Gabby Petito will be held on Sunday in Holbrook, New York. In lieu of flowers, her family is asking for donations to a foundation they plan to establish named for Petito. Wolf?
Athena Jones reporting for us. Thank you. I want to bring in CNN senior law enforcement analyst Andrew McCabe. He's the author of the book, The Threat, How the FBI Protects America in the Age of Terror and Trump. Andrew, thanks for joining us. The search obviously will continue at this nature reserve through the weekend. What sort of information might investigators have if they're devoting all this time and all their energy and resources to this one site?
Well, Wolf, maybe a better question would be, what sort of information do they not have, right? We know that the Laundrie's family pointed them towards this nature reserve. So that's the lead they have to go on. So far, there haven't been any recent sightings of Laundrie anywhere in the area. You know, we have sightings of Laundrie from around the area in Wyoming, where Gabby Petito's remains were found, but nothing since he returned back to Florida. So they are simply they're doing as much as they possibly can do with the lead they have. The concerning thing here is that they haven't had leads pointing in any other direction. So, you know, for now, they'll probably stay the course.
If Laundrie's parents were concerned he might hurt himself when he left the house, why didn't they immediately call the police?
There is no good explanation for that obvious discrepancy. If his family was concerned for him when he left, there's no way to explain why they waited for 3 days before they called the police. It raises some unfortunately uncomfortable questions for them as to were they trying to give him an opportunity to get a head start? Were they intentionally avoiding law enforcement during those 3 days to try to give him some cover to get out of the area, which he certainly could have done? We don't know the answer to that yet. I would expect at some point the prosecutors would be pursuing that with Laundrie's family and maybe even in front of this grand jury.
Laundrie apparently left without his cell phone, his wallet. How much more challenging is it then for authorities to track him down? What else do they have to go to find him, to go off of?
Well, there's not much, right? So particularly without that cell phone, you really lose the electronic advantage that you have in trying to find people these days. There's all kinds of ways that the devices that you carry leave a record of locational data that law enforcement can use. So if he doesn't have any of those electronic devices, you don't have that advantage. You are literally looking for a needle in a haystack. This is one man who may be in a nature reserve that is about 40 square miles. So that's a lot of ground to cover in a few days.
Certainly is. The former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, thank you very much. Meanwhile, there's a new twist in the COVID-19 drama that played out on live television earlier today, only moments before Vice President Kamala Harris was scheduled to appear on The View. Our Brian Todd has new details just coming into CNN. Brian, what are you learning?
These are some wild moments, Wolf. We have just learned that since this morning, the hosts of The View in question, Sonny Hostin and Anna Navarro, have each tested negative twice for COVID. But this morning, as it was playing out live on the air, it was awkward and confusing. On the popular ABC show The View today, an awkward, unscripted moment for co-hosts Sonny Hostin and Anna Navarro after an exclusive interview with Vice President Kamala Harris had been promoted.
Okay, there seems to be something happening here that I'm not 100% aware of. Can someone please apprise me of the situation?
I need the two of you to step off for a second.
Okay.
Anna and
we're going to bring
Sonny
you back later.
Have to
okay.
leave.
Yeah. Yes.
And we'll tell you why.
More information later. It's a tease.
As Hostin and Navarro made their way off the set, more awkwardness.
So shall I introduce the vice president?
Yes.
Okay. So, vice president, no.
Nope.
Okay, shall we dance? Let's do a tap dance.
Another commercial break. Then host Joy Behar returned with the news.
Okay. So, since this is going to be a major news story any minute now,
yeah.
What happened is that Sonny and Anna both apparently tested positive for COVID. No matter how hard we try, these things happen. They probably have a breakthrough case, and they'll be okay, I'm sure, because they're both vaccinated.
The vice president didn't appear until a half hour later in the very last segment of the show. She appeared remotely, and she was on for less than 8 minutes.
Sonny and Anna are strong women, and I know they're fine.
CNN's Brian Stelter reports The View's hosts are usually tested for COVID twice a week, but that they were tested an extra time this week because of the vice president's arrival. A White House official says Vice President Harris, who's received two doses of the Moderna vaccine, did not interact with Sonny Hostin or Anna Navarro before the show. But one medical expert says this could have been a close call for the vice president and speaks to the risks she and the president often face.
Anytime you are surrounded by so many different people from so many parts of the country on a daily basis, you are potentially exposed to that virus every single time.
And Dr. Saju Mathew is critical of how the show handled this.
I think the ball was dropped somewhere. Why did these anchors not know about their test before the show began, especially on a day when you're interviewing Vice President Harris?
Those are among the questions we posed to publicists for The View. Why did the host not learn about the results until the show was on the air live? The publicists have not gotten back with us, nor has Sonny Hostin. I did reach Anna Navarro, who's also a CNN political commentator. She told me she is shocked by this, that she feels great, that she's really glad the vice president is safe. Now, as we reported, two sources have now told CNN that both Anna Navarro and Sonny Hostin have subsequently tested negative for COVID twice since this morning. But a wild scene live on the air.
That's really encouraging that they've both, since the show,
yes,
have tested negative in these various tests. And I hope they are negative.
I think so. It also speaks to the messy nature of all of this, the COVID testing and what we in TV go through, what politicians go through, and everybody's exposed to so many people in those venues. It's pretty tough to deal with.
Brian Todd reporting for us. Thank you. We'll stay on top of this story as well. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Aaron Burnett out front starts right now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.